The Romance of Mystery, Book One. Written and read by Fresney. Or, given that this is a medieval romance, as I should be pronouncing it, Hren. Fandom, Sherlock BBC, Romance of Silence, and Yavan, The Knight with the Lion. Pairings, Sherlock and John, Silence and Lunette, Fate and Choice, but it's a medieval romance. Rating, NC-17, warning for a megaverse, and all that implies. So, the kink trifecta of Dubcon, Nodding, and Mpreg, as well as being a ridiculous medieval fusion. Chapter 1. This lay that I here set down, it is the story of a courteous and generous knight, of the name of Sir Jean Lanval, and the way in which his motto came to be in the Latin, Clausum Mysterium. King Arthur went to stay at his estate in Tregennis, for the summer feast we call Whitsun. He gave to each count and each baron, and to all the knights of the Table Round, great gifts, Omegas and land, great King Arthur shared out with a generous hand to all but one. Sir Jean Lanval, he quite looked away from, and no alpha helped his recall. This was of no fault of Jean's, for he was of both brave and courteous heart. He gave freely of what he had with no stinting. Jean was often the victor in the lists, and greatly he brought his heart and courage to the battlefield. As he was a knight without a state, he was used to supporting himself by his skills alone. He had lately been in the service of a lord of a wandering heart. Jean followed him first to ancient Alexandria and great Byzantium, and from there to holy Jerusalem. There in battle, he took a blow to his shoulder and an arrow to the leg at Damascus, and having been wounded then, was afflicted with a fever of the bowels, which forced him to leave his lord's service. So it was thus, as he washed ashore home, his health found him brown as a nut and thin as a lathe, with no opportunities in the manor where he'd grown up and suffering of his illness. He set forth to find his fortune at the court of King Arthur in Camelot. Whilst he sought his recovery, to his misfortune, he was taken up by a court-wise Omega, Lady Vert, who outside of bonded heat was wont to take up with one or three vassals in courtly love between her confinements. Then, as now, it was understood that to couple outside of bonded heat was a sin, for such could not bear the fruit that was its purpose. Even greater was the sin of despoiling a noble Omega of their chastity, without bond. For in bond was the inheritance of estate confirmed, and made sacred to the good Lord God above besides. Yet also was it well understood that humors might arise were they not drained, which could lead knights to the greater despoiling sin of rutting with an unbonded Omega, or bonded Omegas to stray in heat. Also, in the court of Camelot, the wise Queen Guinevere had sought to engender a chivalrous understanding that for an alpha vassal to take up a love that was generous, patient, and kind, with a bonded Omega was to enrich the vassal in courteous charity. The end result of that charity would be the love of God. By this, Jean was no stranger to courtliness, if of no great station, being a mere knight's son. Sought to live by all that was proper, and do as he ought. His good qualities and love he had established on 3 continents. Never with other than a bonded Omega of greater estate did he take up, and never at their time of heat. Always he strove to improve his good qualities through the courtesy of his service. Now, it was true that his injuries had brought him low, but as he was a well-versed vassal and skilled in providing satisfaction outside of coupling, it should have been no matter. Had the Lady Vert been true, then his good qualities might have been rewarded. But she asked of him more than in his illness he could provide. To his shame of his injuries, he was unable to play that part. It should have ended there. Yet with her wicked thoughts, she then did him a wicked turn. She accused Jean before all the court of having an ungenerous heart and granting his service poorly. Further, she let it be known that the injury to his leg had left him incapable of serving an Alpha's part entirely, which was not true. Jean had been long from Camelot. He had no one to speak up for him. Now, it was that Lord Vert took a great affront to this insult, for his bonded Omega had borne him 6 sons, with all signs that they should be Alphas. In addition, Lady Vert's private confessor spoke up as well, and said he'd heard this spoken of by others in confession. So, the court deemed that the Lady Vert's words must be true. So it was that King Arthur granted him no gifts. Queen Guinevere turned her face from him. The queen's friend of shared marks, Sir Lancelot du Lac, refused to face Jean in the lists. No count would take such an Alpha to his court. No Omega would grant him favors. He was not welcome at the court in Camelot. His reputation was quite in ruins. Even injured as he was, he resolved to find his fortune upon the road. He set out upon a day most fair, and journeyed until he reached the dark forest of Broceliande, where the trees were so closely knit that the sun might as well not shone. Such was the heart of Jean, that he tarried not in beams of sunlight, but went down the center of the road, looking for only what might lie ahead. In time, the forest gave way to a castle black in battlements, and ornamented with no colors. The gates had been left to hang open, and the walls had fallen into such disrepair that saplings grew where the mortar should have tightly joined stone. For all of this, the castle dyer was not untenanted. There in the courtyard, beside the mossy well, stood an ogre of horrid aspect. 10 feet tall he stood, and completely unclothed. So unknown to courtesy was this creature, that he stroked the pillar of his pleasure, and yelled to the heavens, "Slick, sweet, sweet, slick, the Omega is mine to take, and mine to keep. Night, I will grind you beneath my foot. I will make my bread from your bones, and my jam from your blood." The ogre smacked his lips and picked up a mighty staff of oak, all encrusted with rusted iron. Jean's heart did not waver, for even injured as he was, ever true was he upon the field of battle. He rode forward upon his courser red. He held his javelin, and true he struck, but the ogre only laughed and plucked the stick from his flesh. With his sword, then, Jean made battle, leaving aside his trusty courser, that it might not be injured, for such was his courtesy. It was a battle that many should have seen it, but only the crows perched upon the battlements did. Jean moved as quickly as he could, for his armor was but of boiled leather, so poorly was he equipped. He quite forgot his injuries. Quick were his steps, and like the lightning storm were the movements of his sword. Not fast work, but he did his work well upon the ogre. Having defeated the ogre, Jean thought to seek out the Omega, of which the ogre had spoken, to see if Jean might be of some assistance. Jean climbed the blackened stairs of a keep. When he reached the top, the room that he found there was open on three sides, with broken windows, and the dark forest lay exposed to his view. But he cared not for such views, for even with the room open as it was sweetly perfumed with the scent of heat, as stood before him an Omega of surpassing beauty, chained with a length of cold iron to the wall. The Omega had discarded his wimple to reveal fine curling black hair that lay virgin loose upon his shoulders. He wore a rich surcoat of red silk that sparkled with gems laced tightly at his sides. And Jean could see that beneath the surcoat, the Omega wore a cot that was laced exceedingly tight. About his neck, he wore a collar of gold thick with gems. Upon his arms, he wore thick bracelets of gold, likewise so enriched. Upon his bare ankles, he wore enriched anklets as well. From such fineries, Jean knew this to be an Omega far beyond him in station. Still further, Jean's staff, which these months had lain a dry twig twixt his legs, twitched to life once more, and he rejoiced in it. Had he known this would lead to his folly, he perhaps would have left, but most likely he'd have returned straightwise again. But this tale cannot speak of what he did not do, but only of what he did. Jean came forward into the room. No sooner had he entered than the Omega gazed upon him most searchingly, even before Jean had offered his help. The Omega said in deep, rich tones, like the deepest church bell, "Were you wounded in Odessa or Damascus?" Jean was filled with astonishment. Damascus! But how could you know that? And by what magic could you know what was to you unseen? But of greater import, how may I assist you? Who has chained you here, and why? The Omega closed his eyes as if in great pain and stretched the long whippet slender length of his body as if to so grant ease. It should be quite obvious that I chained myself here, that with my heat upon me, I would not go down and shame myself by disporting with the ogre, and so die. The Omega shifted with some discomfort upon bared feet, as obvious as that even as a knight, with no fees owed him, and but lately injured. You have defeated the ogre, and did so on foot, for all that you came here on a red courser. Jean marveled. That is amazing, for it is so. A most becoming flush came to the Omega's cheeks that were like the finest bleached linen and as pale as that which had never seen the sun. I know this by no magic, although the ways of magic are well known to me. The weave of your stockings are quite stained from the grasses grown wild in the yard, where you dismounted. Still further, they are enriched with red horsehair. He wrapped his arms around himself and seemed to take stock of Jean. He breathed in deeply, seeming to like the air. An alpha you are, and a knight errant. You must ride a courser or a destrier, which must have been killed in your battle with the ogre. That he bellows no more indicates your defeat of him. The Omega waved a fine hand in John's direction, and upon his fingers he bore rich rings. But richer yet was the scent that filled the room at his movement. That you wear boiled leather shows that your fortunes are not good. By your skin, brown as a nut, I'd know you as a knight-errant, returned from afar, even had you not the ribbons for pilgrimage, to the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, and the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, upon your sleeve, as you bear on your shoulder and leg, injuries that made you so thin. I ask after the place of battle where you took these wounds. He opened his eyes again, and they were of a silver hue, more shining than any gem. Tell me then, is there aught that I have missed? Jean marveled at the Omega. He swayed forward, but restrained himself from touching the Omega, for such could lead to sin in the Omega's time of heat. I dismounted my courser for courtesy's sake during my battle with the ogre, and no injury to him, for even now he grazes upon the grass with your palfrey below. But beyond this one fact, all that you say is quite true. Your words fill me to the brim with amazement. So brilliant are the rays of your thoughts. Your response is not the general reaction. It seemed as a flush came to the pale cheeks of the Omega that he was pleased with Jean's praise. This tumbled Jean to curiosity. What have others said when you laid their path so clearly bare? The Omega glanced more swiftly then. When I was younger, I was much fawned on, and behind my back was mocked. But in later times, my observations have been met with coarser responses. Jean shook his head at this. Then, as the Omega bore no marks on his neck, but still it were good to ask, he said, "Such responses I cannot imagine. What does your bonded alpha say? Or is it possible that you are as yet unbonded?" The Omega almost snarled his response. "I have sworn never to bond, and have no desire to breed. To the exploration of mystery, I set myself long ago. And it is to this exploration that I consider myself bonded. When my family, a bonded alpha, proposed, I left as the strongest rejection of this idea." The Omega paced to the rattling of his chain, groaned in some discomfort as the perfume of his heat grew stronger yet. He moved to sit in a stone window seat below a gaping opening to the west. Now, though Jean and the Omega could not see it, a battle was even then being fought between gentle chivalry and burning desire, while behind them stood the objects of their affection, chaste action, and nature. Chivalry bore a blade of shining courtesy and a shield of stout honor. Desire wielded double weapons, a mace of ardent love, and a whip of consuming lust. As chivalry brought down his blade upon the mace, chaste action said, "It is not meet for a knight without a penny to greed a gently braised Omega of noble estate out of bond. Therefore, he should leave even now and stand guard at the front of the keep." As desire parried then, and brought forth his whip to flick round the edge of chivalry's shield, and made chivalry hiss at the touch of it. Nature said, when I created Alphas, I granted them the gift curse of rot, with no intention that they should use my gift while standing guard alone and seeding fallow earth rather than a nubile omega. Chivalry lunged with his sword. His chaste action said, you are an unnatural mother, I grant, but it is I who guide knights on the path to a sterling reputation. Nature only smiled as desire with a beat threw back chivalry's blow, and with one hand furiously lashed chivalry, so he dropped his shield, and with the other brought down his mace upon chivalry's chest, so he fell back on the blow. It is no matter. I created courtesy as a blade that cannot be broken. Chivalry lunged in a mighty attack to desire's heart. Nature only smiled and said, and I thank you for its creation, as it is a blade that cuts both ways. For courtesy's sake, nurture teaches omegas to stay silent when they mean no. Although this omega has been let to grow without such intervention, and we'll see what then results. As she said this, desire stepped into that blow and took it to his heart, for courtesy could not kill desire so long as he lashed chivalry with infatuation and scorched him with lust. So smiling nature cast chivalry and chaste action from the room, and instead invited in chaste intention, and in doing turned to Jean standing by the door. The two of them, chaste intention and desire, each took Jean by the hand, while nature laid a hand upon his shoulder and guided him to sit next to the omega. Nature kissed his brow, and, an unnatural mother as she was, sat down to watch what would then unfold. Jean and the omega sat beside each other for a time. With a groan, the omega listed as a tree might do towards Jean, such that his head rested upon Jean's shoulder. Here, truly, Jean's thoughts were only guided by chaste intention. As he brushed his hand through the omega's curling locks and felt his heart thunder a stopping start in his chest as skin met skin for the first time. Often he had heard that an alpha would know their one true love at the first touch of flesh to flesh. He had heard poems of alphas and omegas, unbonded, that exchanged ever furtive caress. But he'd never credited it for true. Credited or not, love broke over him like an oncoming of a storm at the heedless shore. His fingers moved of their own accord across the omega's high cheek, and his chest released a boiling sort of sigh as the omega turned his face to the touch and like a cat lightly licked his palm. Jean swallowed and raised his eyes to heaven. He prayed for strength, but his hand kept on in its motion through tangled tresses and soft skin that fair burned him with want. He turned and pressed a brief kiss upon the omega's brow. Truly, his intentions were entirely chaste in that kiss, and the string of others that he then bestowed like gems of a crown, crossed the omega's face. Then, knowing his actions tended in a direction not good, he pulled back, and to distract himself, he asked, as I have not your great skill at observation, will you tell me how it is that you come to be in this sorry place, alone and at such a time? The omega slid his arm round John's back and nuzzled at his neck, while John continued with comforting him with stroking touches through his hair. So with his deep voice near to Jean's skin, the Omega purred forth this response. I was traveling alone from my home to the convent of the Magdalene in Broceliande, where I am resolved to take up the veil and turn my face towards the exploration of mystery. Jean pressed a chaste kiss to the Omega's cheek, his arm stroking up through the Omega's silken hair, whilst all the while the Omega's long fingers trailed up and down Jean's side. As I traveled, I heard of the curse upon this place, and I resolved to use my knowledge to lift it, which I have done, only then was laid low by my own nature. The Omega paused in his speech to cry out to Christ for charity in his time of trial. Jean sighed in sympathy, as his own staff had hardened like an oak shot with cold iron on that sympathy's wing, and guided by chaste intention, he pressed another kiss, this time to the Omega's lips, which parted before his own as a flower, where like a hummingbird, Jean dared slip in his tongue, as chaste intention quietly left the room, leaving desire to take the lead. Eyes closed, they sat thus for a time, thigh pressed to thigh, and bodies turned, exchanging heated kisses. The only sound their gasping breaths, and birdsong from all round the gaping windows. The Omega's face, Jean framed with his hands, and so felt his body rock, back and forth in an echo of coupling. Jean clung to this thought, as long as they sat thigh to thigh. Naught could occur but aught it should. Finally, sighing for mercy from the good Lord God above, the Omega pulled away, looking down with a modest blush. Sir Knight, you have done me a great service by killing the ogre. Can you not see your way to the sweeter one, of easing my discomfort in such a way as would please you well, but would leave me yet unbred? The Omega placed his fingers across John's lips as he opened them to say there was no such way. So instead of words, John those fingers kissed, as the Omega said, such is the prestige of my family that I have been granted papal dispensation for a stroke or 20 from a Beta's staff in my time of heat. I well know that a single stroke from your staff would ease me just as well as that Beta's 20. He closed his eyes and cried out again, as a penitent cries out to God for sweet mercy, as his heat gripped him tight. Now, John's generous nature worked with his fear that he would be unable to restrain himself to a single stroke, and though he was no stranger to love play, he'd never so much as touched an Omega in their heat. He well knew this proposal was by no means chaste. Though love had struck him a mighty blow, that granted nothing where bonding was concerned. Without the blessing of the Omega's noble family, to trammel with the gently bred Omega's chastity would be a grievous sin. But the idea of a stroke, a single stroke, which by its nature could do no harm, quite set fire to his thoughts, already burning at love's touch. And even further, he reasoned, he would do his love a great service. The Omega placed his hand upon Jean's chest. Please, Sir Knight, can you not observe how I am suffering? Jean breathed in, and all around him was the Omega's sweet scent. His lips tingled from the Omega's kisses. Please, I assure you, it is nothing that I have not done before. These words then gave Jean a sweet relief, for Jean well knew no Omega would seek to take the veil at a convent of the Magdalene that had not some experience in these matters. And if the Omega had such experience of such a stroke before, then it were something that could be done. The Omega said he had papal dispensation. So such a stroke would even be no sin. So Jean bargained with himself that he might do as the Omega asked. Yet there trembled within him one last thread of impediment. But as you yourself have said, your dispensation is for a Beta, which I am not. The Omega pressed his face to Jean's, as if modesty had overwhelmed him. Into Jean's ear he murmured, "Having been granted dispensation for 21 of a Beta, then surely one from an Alpha would be much the same as a Beta's 100. The Omega pressed a kiss to Jean's neck, of which he shuddered on the weight of an idea pleasingly presented, as you possess the key meant for the lock that I hold. How much better the fit, and the more likely it will grant ease with one stroke. Please, Sir Knight, will you not grant me the ease for which we already have dispensation that makes it no sin?"
John gave way quite suddenly. "I am no scholar to argue with your logic. I will do it." Greatly inflamed as he was by the thought of this single stroke, John shed such of his leathers and his clothes that they would not obstruct this course, and turned to find the Omega with his knees upon the seat, faced out the broken window. Having braced himself there, he had pushed up his rich surcot and cot to his waist, quite baring his nether cheeks, while leaving his top modestly clothed. This was the position of love that was then, as it is now, called ruin, for any Omega to take it up outside of bond, for the double ruin of being a wanton bred, and for the shameful reputation of being seen by any who might choose to look up upon the window. The crows that perched upon the weed-grown castle walls looked up and croaked their advice, but went unheeded. Far from turning from his path, the Omega looked over his shoulder and brushed a finger to the pearl that had formed at the tip of John's staff. Taking then that pearl to his mouth, he smiled and turned modestly away. John stood behind the Omega, marveling at the soft purity of his skin, which had clearly never known the sun's touch or the labor of a day's work. No sooner had John performed the teasing touch with the tip of his staff than the Omega cried out, "As you love Jesus, Sir Knight, do not tease me so. I am in great discomfort. A single stroke is all I beg of you. Please give me what you have agreed to." John did not need to be asked again, eager as he was to do as the Omega asked. His only concern was that he'd not be able to withdraw after the single stroke, and so fall into the grievous sin of breeding a noble Omega out of bond, and one so high above him in rank. But that was a faint thought, and dimly felt. What was fully felt was the Omega's well-watered flesh, which parted before his stroke most pleasingly. The The Omega exclaimed on all aspects of what they had just done, in a voice of great surprise.
Sweet Jesus, I can feel you're not within me.
Never have I felt the like. This remark was without sense to Jean, as his knot was no larger than it ever was, but tightly held as he was by the Omega's channel. All Jean could do was give forth his own praises to the good Lord God above, that he had been blessed to make this stroke within his one true love. He thought to couch in the Omega for a while, as he'd have but this one chance. But it came dimly to Jean, as the Omega rocked against him, that he'd been asked for but a single stroke, and so he must withdraw. It seemed to Jean that the tight scabbard of the Omega was as reluctant to release the blade of Jean's desire as Jean was to leave its grip. Still, for courtesy's sake, he withdrew. But for courtesy's sake, he applied the teasing touch to the Omega's well-watered entrance, for surely this were no sin. All the while praying to the good Lord God above that the Omega would desire a second stroke, for Jean reasoned to himself that he had done it poorly and had not even struck the Omega's pearl of pleasure in his haste, which spoke poorly on his service to love. He was about to say so when his prayer was answered, as the Omega cried out to him, as a sinner cries out to God for sweet mercy. O Sir Knight, I am in great suffering. Will you not give me ease of a second stroke, for which dispensation is already given us, as once you granted? Surely it were no sin to grant again. Please, I beg of you, another stroke is all I ask. It was Jean's great pleasure to comply. Once more the Omega's well-watered flesh parted pleasingly before his thrust. Once more the Omega cried out,
Sweet Jesus, you're not! How sweetly it grips me!
For all that Jean's knot was but lightly swelled by the first stroke. Jean marveled as well, for he had never felt the like. But then, he'd never so much as touched an Omega in heat, much less been granted the boon of a single stroke. Again, Jean lingered in that sweet couch. Again, for courtesy's sake, he withdrew, but moved his tip in the teasing touch against the Omega's well-watered entrance. For courtesy's sake, for surely this were no sin. He told himself that in a moment he would step away, but prayed to the good Lord God above that he be granted the request of a third stroke. For Jean had not yet struck the Omega's pearl, and surely, if the Omega was to be satisfied with a single stroke, then Jean must improve his name. He opened his mouth to say this, when the Omega cried out more simply this time,
O sweet Jesus, grant me mercy. It is only through your knotted staff that I find surcease. We have dispensation for 20 more. Please, as you love God, fill me again.
Once more, it was Jean's greatest pleasure to do as the Omega asked. As he thrust in, he knew his aim had been true, for the Omega cried out in a voice as loud and deep as the largest church bell, his delight at being filled so completely to the threshold of his womb. He further marveled in an unceasing brook of words on all aspects of what they had done. Whilst the Omega cried out his praises, the Omega's sheath showered the elixir of the heat, set down by the great Lord God above, upon Jean's staff and burgeoning knot. As Jean pulled slowly forth, that elixir proved no balm, but rather inflamed as oil on a fire. the proof of which was how nature gripped Jean tight, and he found himself quite unable to withdraw. The proof of which was how the Omega choked out these words of commanding supplication. "Do not stint with your mercy. Again, we have dispensation for 500 more. Again, please, again." From then, all thoughts of withdrawal were well and truly flown. No sooner had his Omega cried out, "Again, sweet Jesus, again!" But Jean had already granted his Omega's request with full vigor. No longer stopping, but always in anticipation, Jean plowed forward in advance of the request with answering cries of his own. All thought of restraint gave way as Jean thrust into his Omega as greatly as he had ever striven in the lists. His Omega, in turn, sweetly met each thrust by pressing mightily back, deepening the power of each stroke. The swelling of Jean's knot should have given them ample warning. Instead, Jean praised the good Lord God above for the blessing of dispensation for strokes that made this no sin. His Omega's commanding cries of, "As you have mercy, dispensation, again," dissolved into the simple command, "Again," which John joyously obeyed even before the command was given. However, just as the pilgrim climbing holy Mount Sinai may struggle even as he approaches the top, as all tightened within him in anticipation, John struggled with shallow strokes at his Omega's entrance, for as warmly inviting as his Omega was, the battlements of his gate resisted the admittance of Jean's well-burgeoned knot, which to Jean seemed a great suffering, and he prayed to the good Lord God above for assistance in his time of need. His Omega felt it too, for he cried out as one who faces the loss of salvation, "Why do you hold back? The Pope himself has given me clemency for strokes up to the root. For charity's sake, do not begrudge me the relief that is due me. Please, for God's sake, grant me another stroke." On some last hazy thought, Jean said, "If I do not withdraw, I will not within." But what he prayed to the good Lord God above in heaven for was that he should be blessed to do exactly that. He received in answer only this command, "As you love God, sweet mercy, dispensation, again." In truth, it would have already been too late had the Omega asked Jean to withdraw. It would have been too late when Jean plowed that first sweet stroke. Too late when Jean sat down beside him. Nature's hand gripped Jean tight, and it was too late for anything but what occurred. His Omega's command was not yet complete, as Jean gave a last mighty thrust, that Jean's knot might pass again into his Omega, and be safely couched where nature meant him to be. It cannot be said if this thrust was too soon or too late, only that no sooner had Jean's knot gained entry, but it redoubled in size, such that he to his Omega, they were locked tight together. The word "again" yet trembled on his Omega's lips, as his Omega cried out, "Sweet Jesus, you're not! It is too much! You are cleaving me in half! I did not ask for this! I asked for a single stroke." Jean came to himself in a panic at what he had done. He tried to pull out that he might free them of this grievous sin, but that a moment before he had prayed to the good Lord God above that he might commit. These thoughts came too late, as now well watered in truth his Omega's flesh became, for from John's knotted staff came forth the river of his seed into the firmly banked fields of his Omega's body, which brought with it such pleasure
that Jean could scarcely compass it. Yet dimly, he felt his Omega struggle to break free. His Omega cried out,
"It is too much. I cannot bear it. I did not ask to be bred."
Confusion roiled against pleasure, as Jean's last intention had been chaste.
Chaste was not this, but wanton was,
while before him his Omega gave further panicked cries. So it was to courtesy Jean gave way. Jean slid his hand under his Omega's cot and surcot, and on to the flat plain of his Omega's belly. Pax, sweet pax. Unthinking, a grievous sin have I committed, with my last stroke. But on my soul, now it's done. I cannot free you of this fate. He stroked his Omega's scepter firmly, until his Omega exhaled a soft sob of release. Jean tried, but he could not hold back. So sweetly did his Omega squeeze upon him. He gave forth a second river, that while pleasing Jean greatly, drew still further cries of disbelief from his Omega. As that flood ebbed, his Omega yielded to what had been done, and in leaning against Jean, struggle gave way to exultation to the Lord God above. His Omega cried out his pleasure in a voice as loud and deep as the largest church bell, such that the doves nesting under the eaves of the tower set to flight, and the crows set to calling. Another flood from Jean his Omega's joy brought forth, and Jean joined the Omega's cries with his own. As the tides paused, Jean rested his forehead onto his Omega's still-clothed back, hiding his face from himself. He remembered his thought before his first thrust.
Sweet Jesus, and now I know why this position is called ruin. For well have I ruined you to our soul's peril.
His Omega laughed and threw back his head with its curling locks.
So this is ruin.
He shifted his hips such that he tugged most pleasurably upon Jean's knot. Jean gave way to his cries of release as his Omega laughed like the deepest rolling sound of a church bell upon the birth of a future king. He laughed and laughed, and still laughing, his Omega bent his head down and gave way to further release. Locked as they were, and as mean a space as this was, Jean prayed that this moment to be never-ending, for then all would be pleasure, and never a price. But this prayer was not meant to be answered, for Jean's knot gave way, that the tides might recede and trickle back down his Omega's thighs, as pale as the birch trees that gleam in the woods. The Romance of Mystery, Book 1, Chapter 2. As they untangled, the Omega remarked,
"As the chain has quite lost its purpose, I shall remove it."
Once free of the chain with which he'd bound himself, the Omega stretched. "Although long I had desired it not, I am well ruined." His curling hair was tousled, virginal no longer. "I journeyed to the convent of the Magdalene, or I would have served the penance of sin. I see now why they kept me so mewed up, for the double danger of an Omega man's sanguine nature, and the tales they speak of how an Omega man may occur." The Omega's laugh was rueful then. He looked down at his rumpled clothes, the worse for their activities. Jean had a heavy heart. Never had he experienced the sadness that the French described after coupling. But he had done what no courteous knight should do, and now he felt it in full. "I have bred a gently raised Omega, and one bound for the veil as well." He raised his eyes to the silvered gaze of the Omega. "I am but a knight errant. I will not be granted the right to bond with you. that I might heal this breach. The Omega brushed his thumb across Jean's cheek.
We can each share the burden of my ruin. I am the fool who planned to get one stroke of an alpha in rut, and then begged for 500 more, expecting no knot. You are the fool who listened to my plan and gave me every stroke that I asked for, and more.
Then the Omega winked at him. Jean marveled at the Omega. He could not imagine any other Omega lord or lady who would behave so when presented with this fate.
You are amazing calm in your disposition. The Omega grinned widely. It is amazing that you think so. Although I think I am still ringing with the sweet release that you rang in me. And I might smile and nod at the four horsemen, were they to now appear. Be as such. My plans remain the same. To the convent shall I go, differing only that in 9 months' time, having had the pleasure that comes of breeding, I'll pay the price. A foundling for the convent's orphanage I'll dower as well I can. He touched the gold bracelet, enriched in gems upon his right hand. Jean's breath came quite quickly, for having found true love, he wished he could see some way to, even from a distance at times, gaze on him, which surely the convent walls would not allow. Then came the thought, I'll not even be allowed to see the child I've so unseemly planted. The Omega paused a moment then, nor I, and I shall do the bearing of it. The Omega wrapped himself around Jean, his head resting atop Jean's head, for the Omega was quite tall. His breath was a sweet and steady breeze to the pounding of Jean's heart. He rubbed his hands in small circles on Jean's belly. Pax, sweet Pax. I cannot free you of this fate. As these words sank past the drumbeat of Jean's heart, they pulled forth a laugh. Did I truly say such words while you gripped me tight? Those were the words you spoke. The Omega brushed a kiss to Jean's brow. Jean started with a laugh. To think, this morning, I woke in Camelot. He shook his head, and even as he was enfolded, said, I should leave you. The thought of leaving was like a wound, as all unseen, desire beat him with the mace of ardent love. And so Jean hurt. The Omega rubbed against Jean in an almost idle sort of way, as a cat may rub against one's legs. And I, too, should go, for my convent is not far away. I may reach there before my heat takes me again. Jean breathed out and breathed in. I should go. Then I go too, said the Omega. As the Omega spoke with his deep voice like a church bell, Jean's breath rushed out of his body as if from a blow. For God is a word and God is love, and with words so greatly did love grip Jean's heart that he thought he might break of it. He knew that it would be to his own good not to ask the Omega's name, and as every moment pulled them farther apart, but he could no more stop himself from asking than he could stop the moon in the sky. I am Sir Jean Lanval. Is there a name by which I may know you? The Omega took a step to the stairs, and looking over his shoulder said, You may call me Mystery. Jean felt great relief, then, that Mystery so understood his plight, as to both grant him a name by which to call him, and yet still withhold the name of his birth. They went down the steep stairs and into the courtyard, which it felt as if Jean had left days ago, but there the corpse of the ogre lay, but lightly picked at by crows. Mystery scattered them as he walked to the lump of flesh. Sir John has made a meal of you,
for the beasts of the field and the birds of the air." He then said, still glowing with the joy of satisfaction, "And as the crows were plucking out your eyes, I called out my joy as we cleaved together. So much for your intentions." Mystery laughed again, and to see him were like looking at the sun. Jean wondered again that Mystery could be filled with so much joy on being bred, given the difficulties that might now face him. But looking at him, as Mystery examined the fallen ogre's flesh, he admitted to himself that while it was true that Mystery was his true love, and could with a glance see all of John's history, this gift did not extend both ways. Jean knew nothing of him, and perhaps it would be as easy as Mystery said. Even the name Mystery was a sort of veil that kept Jean from understanding what he saw. He felt what he could not see. Desire lashed him with a flog of intemperate appetite. He said, "You will be going soon."
"Yes," agreed Mystery. Jean found himself standing before Mystery. He found his hands of their own accord brushed down Mystery's strong back and turned up his face to accept a kiss. They stood there thus, exchanging still further kisses. As from a distant land, Jean heard a crow caw. Even with desire flogging them both, he whispered,
"I should go."
"As should I." Mystery pressed himself against Jean fully and sweetly. "Yet the great Lord God above set down this heat upon me, and in coupling I but comply with his will."
Jean's mouth shaped the word no, as his fingers found their way to the laces of Mystery's cot. Mystery aided him in this pursuit, and soon, quite bare, they sank to the fragrant earth.
"Does not the Lord prepare a feast in the presence of his enemies? And for his name's sake, I should sup."
Here a crow flapped his wings from atop the ogre's lumpen flesh as John's lips shaped no, a word he kissed into pale skin that had never seen the sun till now.
"Should I have but a bite of the feast that has been laid before me?"
Jean's staff wept in longing to once more be sweetly couched, as skin brushed true love's skin in the tall grass.
"As long as I eat only of this feast, there can be no sin, but God's will."
"Truly, it is so."
Jean was no scholar to argue. Jean lifted Mystery's legs over his shoulders, as an ox bears a load, and thrust into Mystery. Mystery yelled out to the crows,
"Never better alchemy have I wrought."
Then Jean, to greater speed, drew ever greater cries. Jean pressed on to heaven, with Mystery urging Jean in the name of God to complete the great work of the Philosopher's Stone. When John's knot gripped them tight, Mystery swore he could hear the angels singing. As the breath is the extension of the soul, Jean felt Mystery's soul reach into his own and steal the heart from him. He brushed aside sorrow that they would soon be parted, and set to drinking kisses of Mystery's breath from the cup of his open lips, kisses that Mystery gave him gladly. Finally sated, Jean lay there as one stunned, while Mystery laughed and laughed again. Mystery said,
"I like this feast. Will you stay for further courses?"
Jean coughed to free his throat of the knot that still gripped him there. "I will." For in truth, he did not see how he would be able to leave. Jean followed Mystery to their horses. On seeing the quality of Mystery's palfrey,
as it quietly ate next to his own coarse courser. He was once more reminded that Mystery Station was very high above his own. Still, as Mystery glanced at Jean from the tower's door, he followed. Jean felt every injury and all his latest efforts as he climbed, limping even greater as he reached the top. Looking on him, Mystery said, "I can help you with your injuries." He pulled a jar from a bag rich with embroidery. "As I have said, I am much skilled in magic." His words made sense, so Jean spread out his blanket and lay upon it. Mystery rubbed the salve into Jean's injuries, and Jean felt quite whole again. Jean marveled at Mystery's great kindness to a stranger, who had taken more than was offered. Love pounded in Jean's heart and flowed all through him. As Mystery solved him, even as his touch burned, with a dip of Mystery's lips, to kiss the spot that he had but lately healed, his hair quite tumbled over his face. He said, "In my books of alchemy, much had I read upon the divine transcendence of knotting, of the initial struggle of the knot, like the soul's struggle against the will of God, and the great joy to be had at giving way to it." Mystery lodged his leg atop Jean's, but still, nothing had prepared me for the actual experience of knotting. Before I felt it, I'd have not believed it. Jean was much astonished. He pulled away from Mystery upon the trammeled rushes. "Have you never known heat with an alpha? But how then were you bound for the convent of the Magdalene, which caters to penitent omegas, leaving the path of ruin? What of the previous experience of which you spoke?" "I was bound to the convent for their books, Sir Jean, for their books, that I might delve into mystery. While my family planned to spend me at bond, I plotted how best I might remain unbonded. Even as they signed my betrothal, I made my escape to a place where my value would be my mind." Mystery wrapped himself around Jean again. "As to my experience, as I said, I was granted papal dispensation for the surcease of a stroke or 20, from the staff of a beta, to ease my ache of heat. Although, as they were quick enough to send my friend away, I had use of such dispensation only once." At John's look, Mystery said, "Hyperbole is a valid rhetorical technique. In any case, that time was nothing in compared to being cleaved by you. 'Twas years ago, and is why, with the tongues of heat to inflame me, I calculated that I was owed 500 strokes for those empty years." He moved against Jean most sweetly. "Like Eve, curiosity has always been my begetting sin. Now that you know my ignorance, won't you experiment with me, so that knowing all the extent of my sins, my curiosity may be satisfied?" Over the 3 days that Mystery's heat held them, they coupled freely, until Mystery could in no way be called ignorant in the matters of love play. And he had so surpassed the strokes he was owed, there was no counting of it. Each joining bound Jean's heart tighter, until he knew that on their parting, the stitching of his heart would break. Now, lest it be thought that they spent all their time in coupling, between tangling like vines with soft flowering kisses, they spoke at some length, too. Jean told Mystery of his youth along a lakeside manor. He spoke of his father, a knight in the service of a minor lord, and his mother, a knight's son. He spoke of sailing up the Golden Horn to Constantinople.
while the moon glowed upon the misty water, as if it were a silver mirror, and the rose dawned over the blue dome of the Hagia Sophia. He did not say that Mystery's eyes made him think of that quicksilver water sailing to Byzantium. He spoke of the battle that injured him, and how he'd been forced to leave the court of King Arthur, his reputation in tatters, while Mystery, for his part, related the outline of his childhood, run all but wild for his parents' neglect, and the tower in which he'd spent the years since he'd presented, which, although all lined with learned works, had but a single window open unto the forest below. They spoke tangled on the much-trammeled rushes, between soft kisses. But in truth, they spent a great deal of time coupling. Now this one more thing they were not to know, but nature, having ensured the bond she'd set, had quite forgotten to do the rest. She acted like one who puts on the pot over the fire, but quite forgets to put anything in it after it boils. She'd left them to desire's careful care, and went to see other concerns, intending to return soon to finish her task. Then, on the third day, she remembered what she'd forgotten to do. She returned in haste and somewhat in panic, but was much relieved to find them still engaged as she'd left them, with bleary, reproachful eyes that spoke of sleepless nights and an air of great exhaustion. Desire said, "My lady, I feared you'd not return in time, but faithful to your cause, I've kept them laboring at your task." Nature said,
"And I am grateful for your faithful service."
As Jean's knot caught in Mystery for a final time, and hearing great cries of satisfaction from both the lovers, she set to selecting the seed that she then well planted, and with a sigh, Desire gave way to his own exhaustion. The Romance of Mystery, Book 1, Chapter 3. Finally the heat left him, and Mystery's scent ripened into that of a fecund omega. The feast was done, and it was in their silent aspects that both knew there could be nothing left in their fates but future famine for John and the shame of a belly overgorged for Mystery. Mystery bound the hair that John had tangled his fingers in. He hid those curling locks beneath a wimple, as John told himself was only proper. Mystery put on a rich cot of samite and a cot of silk. Jean dressed silently and made the attempt not to look upon Mystery. It seemed to him a great suffering that they should part now. As if divining his thought, Mystery said,
"It is but a short journey to the convent of the Magdalen, in the heart of Broceliande. A day's ride at most. But there could be dangers, as yet undetermined. It would please me greatly if you would tarry a while with me on my journey. By your aspect, I know that you are one who finds danger most pleasing."
Jean said, "Oh God, yes. No sooner had you made the request, but I was late in complying." He was filled with sweet relief that he would be able to accompany Mystery further and see to his safety. All the while, John knew that he merely put off famine for a day.
Mystery straightened the line of his surcot.
"You should know that sometimes I am given to the humor of melancholy and do not speak for great lengths of time. I also play upon the lute when I am thoughtful. I say this, for those who would travel together should know each other's faults. Will this trouble you?"
John's heart was light, and this shone from his smile. A well-played lute is its own delight. I am to my shame sometimes of a choleric humor.
Thus commended, they went down into the yard together, where Jean helped Mystery onto his waiting palfrey. They set out upon the road, but he could see that Mystery was in some discomfort upon his palfrey. As it was through their vigor that this discomfort was to be had, he asked, "Would it ease you to use the salve by which you healed me upon your flesh? We could tarry a while if it were so." In truth, he meant no importuning by it, for chaste intention rode along beside him. Mystery regarded Jean for a time, and dismounted from his palfrey, expecting Mystery to retreat behind a tree to ease himself. Jean was astonished to see Mystery raise his surcot and cot, and stand quite bare before Jean from the waist down, while yet he was modestly covered from the wimple on his hair to his waist. He presented his backside to Jean. Jean told himself that this was a trial that he should in penitence endure, with chaste intention smiling on, but chaste action entirely absent. Jean took his time to apply the salve. He was sure to apply both within as without. And if he chanced upon Mystery's pearl of pleasure, his chaste intent was only to heal that spot he had so well furrowed over the preceding days. As he finished, he saw that Mystery's scepter had gone from restful to alertly waving its commands, and he cast down his eyes as desire took chaste intention's place and lightly whipped John with a flog of intemperate longing. Mystery looked at him most thoughtfully and said, "You once said that an alpha of lower estate might be raised in refinement through service of love to an omega of greater." He brushed the tip of his scepter across Jean's face. "Though our feast is at an end, you could do me one last service." Jean gasped out his only objection. "For a bonded omega, what you say is true. But these rules do not apply to an unbonded omega." Mystery cupped Jean's face in his hands. "I am but days from taking the veil. Then as bonded will I be. So you may consider me betrothed. And as my family has signed my unwanted betrothal, so doubly am I near to bond. I am an omega of high estate, and you are an alpha of lower. By your own argument, the only result of your service can be your refinement. Please." He brushed the tip of his scepter once more across John's trembling lips. "Will you not swear fealty to me for the duration of our journey? It shall end soon enough." Jean whispered, "Yes, I will do it." So saying, Jean applied his tongue as if he were speaking to the tip of Mystery's scepter, until Mystery cried out. Jean gripped Mystery's strong thighs, like the birch trees that gleam in the moonlight. He applied his mouth further to the task, and took all of Mystery within him. Mystery held him firmly by the hair. Mystery shouted out his joy at the music that bound the celestial spheres. Jean joyfully accepted the gift of Mystery's bitter seed as a sweet balm and swallowed it deeply, as one may swallow a much-loved draught. Mystery blushed then, as was fitting, and let fall the long line of his clothing to once more make a cover for his modesty. "I thank you." His wimple was in some disarray. He set it to rights. They set off then. Mystery looked at Jean often, and Jean rejoiced to be looked upon. Still, to look too long would break his heart, as every step took them closer to parting. They rode slowly for some time, and so did not reach the convent. When it grew dark, they stopped to make camp. Jean made up separate pallets of grass, but Mystery said, "Do not be foolish. Now that you are in my service, we shall lie together upon the same pallet, that you may keep me warm." Jean said, "Should I place my sword between us?" For it seemed to him that he should offer some sign that, having once taken what was not asked for, he should offer assurances that he would now refrain from such behavior. But Mystery said, "That will not be necessary." They sat before the fire for a time. Mystery pulled forth his lute, upon which he played a song of surpassing skill, such that it sounded as if there was more than one instrument. Jean cried out his amazement as Mystery finished. "Is there no accomplishment that is beyond you?" Mystery seemed to think upon it for a time.
"My accomplishments have been confined thus far to my opportunities."
He set to playing another melody then, of a more somber note. As the fire fell into embers, they lay down together on the pallet of sweet-smelling grasses. Jean was resolved not to behave discourteously, so he attempted to put any impure thoughts from his mind. This proved quite beyond him, but he consoled himself that he did not act upon his thoughts. As all the night through, chaste action with chivalry's aid finally won the right to guide Jean. He steeled himself as Mystery first lay next to him, and then, tossing and turning, lay his head upon Jean's chest and curled his feet bent across Jean, with his arm across Jean. Mystery whispered, "I cannot become comfortable." Jean curled his hand over Mystery's and wondered that such a tall Omega would sleep so small. The next day, they came to a branch in the road. To the right, the road led to the convent. To the left, the road wended into darkness. Mystery paused upon his palfrey. He said, "I have heard that there is a most wondrous spring down the road to the left. Perhaps, rather than go directly, we might digress for a small journey before I am to be mewed up behind convent walls." Jean agreed, but Fair came to regret it, as Mystery slipped into a melancholy silence. All that day, Jean endured the pall of it. Once more, Mystery shifted in seeming discomfort upon his palfrey, until Jean could bear it no more. He said, "May we not apply more of the salve to ease your discomfort?"
"No, I only require silence from your foolish prattle."
Jean pulled back then.
Uncertain of what he had done to so deserve such anger, he stopped his horse entirely. It seemed to him that he should not allow such a remark to stand, and yet he had no words to frame his objection.
Mystery turned his palfrey around and stopped there with him on the road.
"Forgive me, my dear friend, but the nature of my discomfort is not of the body, and requires some reflection. As I warned you, I am sometimes of a melancholic temper, and have for some time been unused to company. Will you leave me to my thoughts?"
Jean nodded his agreement, and on they rode. Thus it was that as they came to a steaming spring in the woods, his eyes were turned away from Mystery. Thus, too, he saw the knight in black swing his sword just in time to bring up his own sword. He felt in his heart that he fought for the honor of Mystery, but that he had not the right to call that out, which saddened him greatly. The battle was fierce, and it seemed no blow he landed upon the knight in black's body had a result, while Jean himself grew ever more weary. Mystery called out to him,
"Dear friend, stand back."
He then threw a golden bracelet from his left ankle to the ground, which the knight in black stared at with great focus, and falling upon it, collapsed upon himself. Jean felt emboldened to look upon the armor, which now lay empty on the ground. Jean was amazed at this sight. "It is most marvelous that you knew what to do." He looked through the armor. "But it seems you have lost your bracelet." Mystery smiled then, and appeared pleased at Jean's words.
"I have three more, and the collar. It will be enough to dower our child, and as for myself..."
He placed his hand upon his belly,
I now have all I need to gain entry to the convent, for that is their sacred charge.
Mystery pulled him past the steaming stream to a pool that formed a sort of soaking tub, saying,
Come, my friend. We stink of my heat and your rut. It is only fitting now that we cleanse ourselves.
Mystery removed his wimple and clothes without a hint of modesty, and bid John to do so also, which he did gladly. The water was warm and refreshing. John sat upon a stone ledge within the pool. Mystery shifted upon that stone ledge and would not sit still. Mystery talked for some time about the nature of the pool and what magic rendered it hot. He moved closer to Jean and placed a hand upon his shoulder. He spoke on the birds and the trees and revealed what mysteries granted them the power of flight, and moved closer still. Jean was greatly moved by Mystery's touch and the sight of his hair loose upon his shoulders and his skin so pale that it seemed he'd never known sunlight. But Jean strove to behave with courtesy, with chivalry and chaste action standing behind him. He listened to Mystery, and indeed marveled aloud at Mystery's great knowledge. It seemed to him that Mystery's skin flushed, not only from the heat of the pool, but from pleasure then at Jean's words. Finally, Mystery said, I have been in some consideration upon your service. He stilled Jean's hand then with his own. Having been so served, I have been at the theological conundrum of how I might recompense without sinning. Mystery's hand slowly played at the skin of Jean's arm, and such was Jean's love that the perfume of Mystery's skin proved a soothing balm and an inflaming elixir both. It was then that chaste action and chivalry quite gave up and left them to desire's lashing. Mystery said, It may be sophistry, but it would seem only reasonable that to leave you unrecompensed would be as much a sin as to couple outside of the purpose of coupling. Here he kissed Jean softly, a kiss, the burning elixir and the soothing balm of which Jean in no way could resist, but that Mystery's words took on the shape of good sense to him. I believe I have divined what is surely a lesser sin, and I am, after all, on the way to a convent, where I will reflect in penitence, and where all my sins as yet uncommitted will be absolved. Jean said, I am no scholar to argue with you. All that you say is true.
Mystery moved then to sit upon Jean's lap. For all that Mystery was taller than Jean, he was also more slender, and he fit most perfectly.
Mystery shifted further in Jean's lap, twisting about, until he had Jean's staff between the pillars of his thighs, like the birches that gleam in the woods.
Is this pleasing to you? This came to me as I saw you fighting the night in black. It is of my own divining.
Jean whispered softly, that he might not make unseemly cries, here in the open woods, where any traveler might hear. Yes, sweet Jesus, what you do is good.
Mystery set in a steady motion that drove Jean's staff between his thighs, while he let Jean worship at his scepter with his left hand.
Jean lost himself to discretion, and went further still as he spoke his praises of Mystery, and the greatness of his actions, that so brought John closer to God.
When they had strung the water with the signs of pleasure, Mystery bestowed on John a kiss of his lips.
Mystery seemed so pleased that John had not the heart to tell him that he had not invented this practice.
Instead, John returned Mystery's kiss gladly, with further additions of his own. When they were done and quite clean, they rose out of the pool.
Jean dared to ask, May I have a favor to wear as a sign that I am in your service? His heart pounded in his chest, such that he thought it would fly out.
Mystery considered this, and pulled a ribbon loose from his surcoat.
Then, quite marvelously. Rather than bind it to Jean's arm, he bound it around the swell, where Jean's knot would be during rutting.
Only I may remove this ribbon, and if any other does, I will know it.
Jean could not fathom what this could mean, for he could not fathom how he could cleave to any other than mystery. He told himself to put steel in his heart, even as he marveled that it seemed every movement shifted the ribbon upon his staff and reminded him of mystery's power over him. They camped beside the spring, and in the morning made much the same use of it again, as mystery made argument that they might not have a chance for its like again. He insisted also that they take the armor for Jean's use,
for surely I have paid the price for it with my gold.
Greatly humbled was Jean, for he'd never been so richly fitted by any lord or lady that he had served. He put it on, and now better outfitted, they set forth. His heart was heavy, for soon they must to the convent come. But as they came to the next branch in the path, where the right led into the valley where the convent lay, and the left led up a hill, Mystery said,
"I have heard tell that there is a grove of singing trees, guarded by a three-backed dog, who was once an Omega and her two Alpha lovers, and was so transformed for the sin of joining three at once. This lies down the leftward path. It could be dangerous were we to go see it."
Jean smiled widely and said, "Then let us go." They turned to the left. They ever turned to the left. So it was they circled the convent many times. They were once met by bandits, who Jean slew while shouting that he served Lord Mystery, who knew and observed all. All the while, Mystery's token about the curve of his knot served a further reminder of whose service he was in. As the bandits lay dead, Mystery went round examining them, saying,
"A greater Alpha than you is in my service. He has left your bodies to be eaten by the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. You are nothing but a feast for the crows, who watched me from the corpse of the ogre that he had killed as I coupled with him."
Jean felt oddly puffed up as Mystery said it. That night, as Jean lay upon the pallet, and Mystery made a pallet of Jean, with his head upon Jean's chest, Mystery said,
"I have been at some great thoughts these last few days."
He wriggled then slight, but in such a way that brought his scepter in line with Jean's staff.
"Papal dispensation was granted me, that in my heat, which God intended to bear fruit, I be granted a beta strokes outside of bond, which could bear no fruit. Dispensation given, this was no sin."
Jean dropped a soft kiss then onto Mystery's head. In the wide world beyond the woods in which they now traveled, always love had been an Omega's to grant and withhold, and for which an Alpha must beg.
While it were baffling that Mystery believed the reverse to be true,
it was best that Mystery define what should be done, as Jean had so injured his love once by taking more than had been offered.
As it was, Jean was greatly pleased to be in the service of so demanding a lord, who furthermore held his heart.
He knew full well his own love must be writ clear, but that he had to cloak it for courtesy when Mystery finally took the rightward-turning path, as needs he must. Time itself would enforce it. So he dropped soft kisses, but as you said, that dispensation was only once.
"Used only once, but it came with no end date. So, as a study of induction would have it, already fessened as I am, the corollary must be true, and I have dispensation to couple with an Alpha, outside of bond, where fruit already ripens." Also,
he leaned closer and whispered in John's ear,
"Dear friend, as you have already well plowed me, will you not convert your plowshare to a sword, I find I have further use of it.
So saying, Mystery unloosed the token and moved to ride astride John. When they had both been well pleased, Mystery rested his head with his hair loose upon John's shoulder, which he himself had healed.
You sang my praises when you fought this day.
John grew concerned, because he had not asked permission before he sang those praises. Was I not to speak the name you've given me? As it concerns your reputation, I will not do so again.
Mystery lay still.
Do not be foolish. It pleased me greatly to hear your words. You may continue thus.
He shifted to lay all the closer, with his head over Jean's heart. Jean slept, and woke greatly refreshed. He was most joyful that Mystery had returned his token to its previous location, and yet he could not divine how their journey could long continue. Still more, he could not fathom what could be left of Mystery's reputation when they were done. For Mystery was ever wont to say what he saw, and he saw everything. If a woodcutter's bonded coupled with a tinker, then he told the woodcutter of it, to the discomfort of all involved. When the witches in the wilding thicket used eye of newt, he called them scabrous pansy flaps for not using salamander's tail, and left Jean for fast speaking, lest they be transformed into the salamanders. If a hunter chanced to graze a unicorn with his bow, Mystery railed up and down, and Jean was forced to shoot the beast himself, lest Mystery be gored. If he thought a nut-gatherer a moonstruck molly-flop, he so called her, with biting words that could set souls to ribbons with their venom. Now on that occasion, Jean's choleric nature rose up, for he could not stand such discourtesy. Jean was much wroth, and exchanged words with Mystery at the time to no effect. Jean fumed over it all day long. That night, he built two pallets before the fire. Mystery said, "What foolishness is this, my friend? You cannot still hold a grudge. She was a moonstruck mollyflop. She mistook a feral dog for a yeth-hound, which is in all ways dissimilar. She did this by moonlight, which makes her moonstruck. She spread this tale with a flopping tongue, which makes her a mollyflop. I only spoke the truth, and you may not censure me for it, but rather you should praise me for my discernment." He smiled then, in the manner of one who considers the argument made and won. In his choleric mood, Jean was not inclined to play that game. Jean said only, "That poor villain was terrified to tears, and by your words, in no way did you ease her terror, as is the responsibility of both your position and your wit. Instead, you chose to sharpen that wit upon her tender ears for your own amusement." He turned from him then.
"This night, I do not feel much inclined to be your friend."
He went to sleep upon his separate pallet. Rather, he lay sleepless. With anger holding watch, he stared at the night sky. As Mystery tried, from the time that the moon rose in the sky to the time the moon set behind the trees, with all the logic and rhetoric at his command, to sway Jean, finally falling silent as his voice grew hoarse, and Jean was in no way swayed, but rather only repeated, "This night, I do not feel much inclined to be your friend." Sometime in the early morning, Mystery crept into Jean's pallet, shivering.
"I am cold, without my friend to keep me warm."
Jean handed him his blanket and moved to the other pallet. "Odd, I find it unseasonably warm." Mystery huffed and he sulked, and he was quiet all the next day.
That night, Jean again made 2 pallets. Again, mystery argued to no avail. Again, he crept into Jean's pallet in the night. My friend, I am on fire with needing you. Won't you grant me succor?
As you are not in heat, the word you seek is want, not need.
Jean shoved mystery off him then,
which turned into a sort of wrestling match, such as God and Jacob once did. Except on that occasion, Jacob did not try to cozen God into coupling beneath the stars.
Jean flipped mystery onto his belly and sat upon his back until morning. All the while, mystery complained that Jean should not so treat a fessened Omega, well plowed by the very one on his back, when the Omega had but asked for a single stroke, and had had papal dispensation besides, and on such a bitter cold night as this, and that Omega had need of that plowshare as a sword. And so he went on and on until he could speak no more. Anger holding watch.
Jean kept watch with him and was not moved.
The next morning, mystery sulked, and he was quiet. At midday rest, he said as if suffering great abuse, I beg forgiveness that you are offended.
Jean's response was mild. I am not the one injured. There was nothing for it, but they went back, and Mystery apologized so prettily to the nut-gatherer that she blushed and stammered her own apology in her confusion, and Jean was forced to conclude that she might actually be a moonstruck Molly Flop, not as he would say so. That night, Mystery made the single pallet of dried grass and made a pallet of Jean with a happy sigh. If, in the night, Mystery reenacted the wrestling match between God and Jacob, to rather different results, that was between them and the moon, and the nearby carter, who chanced to hear Mystery's loud praises to the good Lord God above. Mystery's mood was only sometimes cutting. There were other times. If Mystery thought a traveling player was good upon the hurly-burly, he'd pull out his lute and set to playing, without any sense of propriety. He would smile at Jean, who could feel his heart creak in his chest. One day they met 2 villains, an Omega man and a Beta woman, brother and sister to each other, after Mystery most quickly deduced that they fled the Omega's bonded for unwanted affections. He handed the Omega the bracelet that he wore upon his right ankle, saying, As my dear friend has already well dowered me, for where I plan to go, as I have enough, you take this, that you may support yourself in a market town, until your sister gain employ, with whatever guild will take her on. On seeing this generosity, Jean sighed. Immortal Love, who had been all this while standing by, gently pushed aside her bonded desire. With a kiss. She then took up Jean's hand so that he'd raise it to his own chest and feel his heart beating there. She kissed his eyes so he would know that the love he'd felt ere now had been a candle to his present bonfire. It was not gently done, for immortal love is no gentle mistress, but is rather cruel as kind. Still, desire and immortal love riding pillion, they made leftward way through the forest. Mystery chanced to hear of a crystal cave from a passing hermit, which was a fine adventure. After which, Mystery raised his arms in the sunlight and marveled. I am quite covered in kisses from the sun. How marvelous! It is most certainly ruin rising to the surface. We must at once to more assiduous application. That I might be all over nut brown, by removing all my clothes, and be further at the ruining of me, and would not be moved until Jean gave his assistance. They treated with the kindly basilisk,
who mystery deduced was no monster, but a guardian to a well, blessed by St. Ignatius the Elder, having bid the basilisk their farewells, and made camp in the place that they had the night before. Mystery urged Jean to dalliance, saying, "Surely, it is God's purpose that we do so, else it would not lead us to such exaltations in his name. Elsewise, I am soon for my penitence. It were a sin not to gather sins, that I might have something to repent. Please." Jean said, "I am long won over. I do not need such great displays of rhetoric. I am no scholar, and I was convinced before you began." He then provided a proof of this. As their circumnavigation continued, summer fell into deepening autumn. Mystery fell greater and greater into silence, as the swelling of his body gave greater proof than mere enrichment of Mystery's scent that he was fessened. Jean worried at that silence, as a dog worries a rat, and was snapped at for his troubles. They investigated the appearance of a ghostly hound, which plagued a cursed family. They were able to send it back to the hell from which it came, after some difficulties. As they lay in that family's hayloft, and burrowed there for warmth, while below them the cattle stomped in blessed sleep, Jean lightly stroked Mystery's arm upon their shared bed of straw. Mystery said, "The equinox lies a fortnight behind us, and within the month the first snows fall." With that he turned over and gave Jean the kisses of his mouth. As this was not an observation that required marveling, Jean did not marvel at it, but rather drank down kisses, as one may drink down the last well at the desert's edge. He greatly feared that this time there would be no salve that would prove a balm for the wound that was to come. Fate, sitting by the sleeping roosters, kept her own counsel. The Romance of Mystery, Book 1, Chapter 4. On the morrow, they left their hayloft, and on reaching a turning of the ways, once more turned left. They came to a market town by mid-morning. The people there were most kindly. The guards at the gate brought them to the ruler of that place, and of a county to the east, Countess Serpentine, who was a most handsome elf of fine address, and treated them most courteously, and, by her aspect, was clearly much taken by Mystery, even given his present circumstances. For when Mystery laid his hand upon the curve of his shape, his cot now but lightly laced, a lock of hair escaping the confinement of his wimple, Mystery said in a proud manner, "You find me in my trammeled state, on my way to the convent of the Magdalen, for reasons that are apparent to anyone with eyes to see, though most are blind enough. With me is my dear friend and vassal, Sir Jean, who well dowered me for my admittance there." Jean flushed to hear it put so, but the Countess Serpentine laughed. "You are strangely direct in your manner for a mystery. I think instead I'll call you Honesty. Which is more becoming?" "Here, then, Lord Honesty, take a seat besides me, that you might refresh yourself." The Countess Serpentine arranged for a tourney in Mystery's honor, or as she called him, Lord Honesty, and for a rich seat to be set at the Countess's side, that Lord Honesty might sit there. Jean strove mightily in the lists for the honor of Mystery, and defeated all he faced. But when he chanced to look up, he saw Mystery in close conversation with the Countess Serpentine, and his heart grew heavy. He knew that Mystery had been much closeted in his tower, and since presentation,
had never been in the company of an alpha till now. Without knowledge of staff play, Mystery was much taken with Jean's poor example, but given a wider field, Mystery was best served by greater players, and one so well endowed with vast estates. Jean knew it, and yet the thought was as a thorn-wrapped vine sliding through him in immortal love's hands. It was as the Countess Serpentine invited Mystery to view her library of some over 100 books that Jean could take no more. He excused himself with great politeness. Mystery appeared most confused at his leave-taking, but Jean steeled himself against that look. He went to the bed in the bachelor's quarters the Countess Serpentine had set aside for him with some dozen other knights. This separation was as a coat of lead upon his movements. He consoled himself that his Mystery seemed disinclined to go to the convent, for all he spoke of it. Then Countess Serpentine was a goodly match for Mystery. In Mystery's current state, the friendship of such a worldly countess would be a boon that would wash Mystery's sun-kissed skin back to pallor and calluses remove. Further, these walls were thick, would stand against the winter snows, which was far more than Jean could offer, although such could not wash away the sin of what they had done, and what Mystery would need to do for such a friendship. Further, there was the danger to their child, for all that a foundling's life would be its lot, were Mystery to be tasked to repay friendship while still so burdened. It pained Jean that it was he who had escorted Mystery to this place, and resolved to beg him to go to the convent on the morrow. So it was that as he lay upon his soft bed, he was easily wakened when a figure stole into his room. His heart leaped before quieting, when he realized that the figure was too small to be Mystery. Instead, it was Lord Viper who had crept into his room. Lord Viper said, "I was much impressed by your prowess in the lists, and would be your friend, as I am a beta, and unlike your overripe lord, cannot be quickened by you." So saying, he reached for Jean's staff. Jean pushed Lord Viper's hand away before he could dislodge the ribbon that Mystery had placed there. Jean backed away from Lord Viper, but he clutched Jean in an embrace from which Jean could not disengage with any courtesy. It was then that the door was flung open. Countess Serpentine stood in the doorway with a lamp of clear oil. Mystery stood at her side. Countess Serpentine said, "As I told you, your dear friend has proved unfaithful to your affections. You should seek out new and better friends." All around them the night slept on as if made from wax. But Mystery only laughed with great scorn. "You must think me a fool to fall for such a trick. I do not need to see that my token has not been removed from my friend's staff to know that he has been true to me. As I have said, we journey together to the convent of the Magdalene, and nothing here shall turn me from my destination. Serpentine you are named, and like a serpent you are, for how else should the ruler of such an estate stoop to such trickery?" "My friend, you are not of great brilliance, but by your reflection you cast light." Mystery raised his right hand. "Ostendo vestri ignavis." It was then that the air wavered, as under a great heat. The castle and town around it disappeared, and instead they stood in the mouth of a great cave. Countess Serpentine and Lord Viper transformed before their eyes into great serpents.
I suspected as much when I saw the nature of your masonry and the quality of your books. But by Jean's words, I knew. So saying, he struck at the serpents with a whip of red leather that he had gotten from the witches in the Wilding Wood. The great serpents recoiled from him as if he held a great flame. Jean could not be motionless while mystery held off the creatures. He took up his sword and set to battling with them. He was almost struck by Viper, but was saved by mystery. Viper shrank at the whip's touch until he was no more than a worm, easily dispatched. So too they dealt with Serpentine and the further denizens of that foul town, until they stood among only dead worms and were triumphant. Jean looked in amazement at mystery. How could you possibly have known that this town was in fact peopled by phantasms and serpents? Further then known that the whip would so discommend them? Mystery waved the whip in the air. It is quite simple. If you are familiar with the Naturalia Animalium by Pliny the Elder, which I am, but we should be away from here. There are humors in the air that are not to our health. They found their mounts eating peacefully in a field, so they set off into the dark. Finally, they came to a shepherd's hut, which Mystery assured Jean was not peopled by monsters. Jean set to lighting a fire and seeing to Mystery's comfort. For his part, Mystery was most discomforted. What is it about you that I am so out of comport? I should have been to the convent months ago, but instead I meander with you on these pretty adventures. This day, I should have seen what they were immediately, but instead my mind strayed to thoughts of being cleaved by you in a silken bed with a goose-down tick. Where my thoughts once tended to mystery, now I am forever upon thoughts of you. Then further still, I was distracted by your leave-taking. Mystery gripped Jean tightly. You never reach for me, while I am always reaching for you. Jean laughed bitter then. I do not reach for courtesy's sake, that I might pay you the respect that once I failed to give you to your cost. Without that restraint, I'd be at you every moment for your embrace. Then I hate your courtesy. We are bringing a life and a death into this world, and that is not a courteous thing at all. With these words, Mystery bent to take a kiss from Jean's mouth. It was not a gentle kiss. There was a wildness in Mystery that night that raised an answering wildness in Jean. Mystery scratched long red runnels like the lines in a wavering field upon Jean's flesh. So, too, Jean dug furrows with his fingers into the skin of Mystery, now freckled as if by cinnamon upon cream, and considerably roughened after these long months of wandering. And Jean rejoiced that their time together had so marked him. Without words, Mystery bared his neck to Jean's teeth, and setting aside the collar of gold, and with no greater invitation, Jean made his mark upon Mystery with his teeth. Though he knew a bonded mark was not his right to make, without the blessing of Mystery's family, the longing of long months bore its toll. Having taken what was not his, he bared his throat in turn, and Mystery marked him there as his own. Through all of this, and although there was a rough bed, they strove together on the earthen floor, not even softened by rushes. Jean cleaved Mystery with no courtesy, but great urgency. They spent themselves thus. The storm having passed, Mystery stretched in great languor. He said, I was going to the convent of the Magdalene in Broceliande, where I was to turn away from the world, the better to discern its mysteries. He moved sweetly against Jean. How could I have seen the path that I am now on? It is fortunate that I am well versed in philosophy, that I may face this turn of events. He rubbed salve into the wound upon Jean's skin, and offered the jar of salve to Jean,
who soothed mystery in his turn. In the instant that it was applied, their wounds were healed. Immortal love, kneeling by, kissed their former wounds. And so, although the bites had not been deeply made, nor had they bathed those marks in the ointment the church keeps for that purpose, the scars of a bond remained upon their flesh. Upon viewing those pale marks, Mystery said, "If God is love, and all other loves a reflection of that great love, it is but simple to deduce that by my granting my love to you, and you granting your love to me, we do nothing of mere dross, but something divine, and divinely required. What need I of a convent, then, that already daily worship?" He looked then upon John, intent as if to further draw out the soul that he had already taken ownership of. "As you see the logic of this, please, when I've done poorly on account of the evil flowing from the hateful demon's blood that rendered me both man and omega, think on the divine mystery, and not the mere mortal one, and do not your love from me withhold." "I do not know what you mean by demon's blood, for though I've heard this slander said, we do not believe it in Camelot. We know that omega men are merely of a sanguine nature, which delights me greatly, to be so loved by so demanding a lord in love. Also, while licensed to every misbehavior, I have no wish to grant. But still I acknowledge that, as I told you, I am of a choleric temper. When our natures do collide, please touch me on the mark you've made, that we remember this and remember love." John laughed, for what else could he do? "Know that you already have my love, but it seems I needed such scholarship to teach me grant it." As they kissed, he closed his eyes against the world. John knew full well that they could not make a formal bond without the consent of Mystery's family, and he could not see a way to it. This moment did not resolve their need for walls. He had no place but this borrowed hovel. Their child would a bastard be, and without the convent's cleansing, Mystery would bear the sin of bearing it. But Mystery focused rather on their love. "For all I can see, how could I not see your love? For much my fear of its lack has been my torment, and ever I turned us leftward to give myself more time to love and gender. Now, like Saul upon arriving in Damascus, the scales are lifted from my blindness, and I see your love is shown from your every action." So saying, he stroked Jean's skin with calloused hands that pricked at flesh and then worshipped with his mouth until they began the slow, sweet work of joining again and on into the early hours. Still tangled thus as flowering vines upon a tree, where it may not be possible to easily discern where one ends and the other begins, they fell into sleep. The Romance of Mystery, Book 1, Chapter 5. It was so they were found in the morning, by Mystery's elder brother, Prince Mycroft. For Mystery, or rather Prince Sherlock, as he'd long ago been christened, was of royal blood, and thus of the highest rank. He was so far from Jean's station as to be a star. They were quickly ripped from each other's embrace by Prince Mycroft's knights. What had tangled been was made untangled. Without fear of modesty or shame, although nude he was as God made him, and thus displayed for all his heat's consequences, Mystery said, "Cursed brother, I am greatly surprised to see that you pride yourself from the shell of the halls of rule. Further yet, that on being so softly exposed, you did not shrivel up and die.
would that you would do so, before you commit such a sin as separating what nature intended. Now, nature, standing on, shrugged and said, I have accomplished what I set out to do. Bonding is not my doing, only breeding. And I am the more pleased by the more widely spread it is. On hearing this, immortal love gave her bonded desire a pointed look. Prince Mycroft gave forth a patient smile, somehow knowing that he had nature's blessing. Long have I known your intention to seek the convent of the Magdalene, for it was I who put the idea of their library and devotion to the great mystery in your head, that when your spirits took the bit to run from wiser heads' intention, I might find you easily. So there my vassals have waited these long 5 months, until, much worried, I set aside delicate concerns abroad that were to our kingdom's benefit, that with your folly you have disrupted, and set forth behind you on your path, which has been a miracle in circumnavigation. Mystery smiled. Our kingdom's benefit? Then it is not the band of a Roman consul I see on your brow. And all your knights are not nobles of Ostrogoth birth, a sign of rising favor in that court. Not our kingdom's benefit, but your own. I say that you strive to be Caesar in the West by the time you are 25. Would that you would return to that effort and leave me to mine. Yes, to my benefit, which I set aside for your benefit. Prince Mycroft made a cutting gesture, as if his hand were a sword, for well I knew the cruelty of the world to a tender innocent, such as our father, the king, would have kept you. Would that I had never set the idea of the convent down, now that I see you tender innocent no longer, having quite set aside all the tenets owed not only to your station and society, but to yourself as a practitioner of the great work of alchemy and delver into mystery. Mystery turned away his face and placed his hand upon his belly. John picked up the blanket but lately loved's coverlet and numbly offered it to Mystery as all he could give, and all Mystery further was allowed to take from him. Left then with only rushes to cover his shame, he took them up. So clothed he was as Prince Mycroft turned and addressed him. It is clear that you are a landless knight, with nothing to offer but some skill at planting between heated cheeks. What we have kept unblemished, you have stained. But, to preserve the appearance of purity, what price will you put on your absence, and greater yet, your silence? There is no price to my silence, and I will constant stay, having already vowed it thus. Jean looked to Mystery, and felt his heart twist upon himself, for he knew he could not pay what price a king would demand for a dower settlement on one so high above him, as a prince of royal blood, in a family high enough to reach for the laurel leaves of Rome. Prince Mycroft said in a philosophical way, you are loyal on short acquaintance, and for less right, but perhaps you merely seek to raise the price with the appearance of such. But at Jean's expression, Prince Mycroft looked as if he ate a persimmon entire. I see it is not so. A pity. A man with a price is far more useful than a lover without price. Mystery laughed. In any case, there is no use to his silence. I have disported with him across half the countryside, and have no reputation to save. You may as well give me to him, and be done with well-used goods.
Prince Mycroft used his fingers to make a vice upon his nose, and having so pinched it, said, "Brother, it is good to see that when you do a thing, you do it most thoroughly. For all of that, I can mend what you have tattered." He made as if to sew a seam. An Omega named Mystery so disported himself with an errant knight before villains, whose words may be questioned, as you are no mystery to me. No lasting damage to your reputation need have been done. Mystery, clothed in love's coverlet, pulled against the knights who held him. He said, "What love and nature have joined, the world should not attempt to set asunder." As nature shrugged again, immortal love laid her hands upon Jean's shoulders, that his heart might swell on her support. But Prince Mycroft smiled, as the wolf presented with a playful pup might smile. "Brother, it was I who sharpened your native wits with the art of rhetoric, that you might have that knife to use for your advancement. So of love's bond, I say that you may understand my meaning. Tantamanta contrar commodestar. There is no bond that cannot be undone." He made a gesture like a bird settling on a branch. "An errant knight cannot grant a penny before the bounty which your betrothed, the Prince of Gore, may and must settle upon you for your bond. Truly, I do this for your own benefit. I know that you have the rhetoric and the will to use it. Where our father, the king, would have left you nude in a tower for the sin of your presentation and supposed demon blood, I have set before you this path, that you might prosper." Mystery drew himself up to his full height, and seemed to clothe himself in fresh beauty, were that possible. "Brother, for all that I was set upon the convent of the Magdalen in Broceliande, now set am I upon my new path. He who commits a sin against love, and if love then God, in moving me from my present course. Fessened as I am, meet it would be for me to bond with the one who strove to the will of God above when God set my heat upon me. To argue otherwise is to argue not with me, but with the divine." "It is clear I should not have taught you sophistry, and by extension heresy." Prince Mycroft laughed fully then. "Knowing how you ever disdained the idea of bond or breeding, I thought I'd have a far different argument with you. Never would I have thought you would come to such a pass. But to the convent of the Magdalen you must go, for the more regular reason. For therein you may pass from your body that which is unwanted, and then be transmuted, as if made into a fresh virgin body." Mystery made to laugh, but Prince Mycroft continued, "Truly, it will be so. You know I have such craft as to make it happen. Dross may be burned away through other than alchemy." With greater guile then, Mystery said, "I shall never bond with this alpha that you have set, and to prove this truth, I shall set this wager." He held out his hand. "Bring the alpha before me. I assure you, I shall turn from him, but without a word or shameful act from me, and all words of your own craft, set to making him agree to our bond. He from me will run away. If this occurs as I've laid it down, you will apply all your craft to getting our father, the king's, permission to leave me to bond as I will, with no dower settlement required but that of John's person. The alpha you will meet, and in doing so you will see the benefit of that path." Once more Prince Mycroft smiled, as a wolf looking on a pup. "But I will take your wager. If you your craft so prove, I will give you my support. And yet, knowing your ways, I shall withhold the question of settlement, that you do not do yourself out of what you are owed for your worth. So saying, they shook upon it, and swore to the great Lord God above that it should be so. In his heart, Jean despaired. The memory of Mystery's heat burned in his mind, and knowing that he himself at the time to Mystery had been a stranger, he could not imagine that Mystery could resist an alpha of worthy estate when that heat was upon him again. Further yet, there was no alpha in the world entire who would turn from Mystery. Mystery winked at Jean and said, "Take heart and trust in me." At her mortal love's urging, Jean resolved to take heart. He followed behind Prince Mycroft and his knights, as they took Mystery to the very place he had wished to be. From there, Jean's days took a regular turn. By day he stood vigil outside the convent, waiting for those moments when he would glimpse Mystery, walking restless upon the walls. Although his attempted messages, clasped to dove's wings and sparrow's feet, were all intercepted by the wily Prince Mycroft and the Mother Superior, still, the sight of Mystery much composed Jean. By night, Jean lay prostrate in the position of penitence on the floor of the shepherd's hovel, praying to the Lord God above for a miracle. This he was not given, or at least he did not discern it. One day, Mystery did not appear on the wall. Instead, as he came to his daily vigil, the Mother Superior summoned Jean within the convent's thick walls. He did not need to have Mystery's gifts to know that the words she brought were not good. She looked upon him with great resolves of steel. "Your child was born twisted, a sign that your passion was without blessing. Further yet, this child has taken Prince Sherlock into the hereafter." She waited a moment and made the final blow. "So it is by the seed that you planted that grew the poisoned fruit that killed him." With these words, Jean's heart broke, and with his heart went his mind. His soul rushed out of his body with all his breath, and it seemed that all that was left was a wild animal. How he made his return to the shepherd's cottage, where last he'd lain with Mystery, he could not have said. He made the journey as a wounded animal does, seeking shelter, immortal love, tears streaming freely down her cheeks, following after. The Romance of Mystery, Book 1, Chapter 6. As an animal, Jean lived, eating grass and small game. He wore their skins as his clothing, and he allowed his hair to grow quite long. Entirely unshaven and without courtesy he was. His only courtesy was that he kept himself from places where people were, so greatly choleric was his disposition. Falling into melancholy, when Mystery's favor rapped on him, quite fell apart, leaving him with nothing. A full year went by. Jean remained unchanged in his wildness. It was in the fall of the year that as he went to check his traps, he found a black leopard with eyes of silver, which had caught its foot in one of his snares. About the leopard's neck was a collar of richest gold, enriched all over with gems, and upon its right paw was a bracelet of gold, likewise so enriched. The leopard mewed, as if in great pain. Beside him lay a little kit with golden fur and blue eyes. It seemed then as if some veil was lifted from Jean's mind, and courtesy returned to him. he consoled the leopard. "Fear not. I will help you." Without a trace of fear, for what left did he have to fear? He freed the leopard from the snare. He waited for the leopard to leap upon him. Instead, the leopard set to purring and moved against Jean's legs in a manner close to oversetting him. He picked up the kit, who scrubbed Jean's face with joyous licking. Laughter bubbled up inside Jean and stopped in his throat. It was his first laugh since Mystery had died. The leopard was most affectionate. If Jean ignored him, the leopard would moan and carry on until Jean would pet the soft velvet of his fur, and then the leopard would purr and rest his head upon Jean's lap. At night, he worked his way onto Jean's pallet and rested his head upon Jean's chest. The kit as well slept at Jean's feet. If his pallet was over full, Jean could not have said that he minded, for the leopard set Jean to mind of Mystery, and if for a moment when he first woke, his waking mind thought Mystery yet lived, he welcomed that dream. Yet on waking, he sorrowed again. He whispered to the leopard his wish that as he traveled with Mystery, he'd been the one brave enough to lay siege to virtue, and shouted his love. Now knowing how short that path would be, and how little courtesy repaid him, the leopard would moan and rub its head against Jean's stroking hand, and roughly lick Jean's face, watching him throughout the day as the leopard groomed the kit. Invigorated to life by the presence of the kit and the leopard, Jean resolved to return to the world. He set his clothing and self to rights, and freshly bathed and shorn, he set forth for Camelot, thinking to take what mean lot could be made available to him. Jean turned down the rightward-turning path, and soon it made his return. Jean found himself much without place, but they did not turn him away. He began again. His new beginning went quite well, when long ago, it seemed, he'd arrived at the court of Camelot. He'd been a lone knight, much made ill by his travels. This time, he returned with the reputation of a year spent mad for love, and was now accompanied by a courtly leopard in his kit. When Jean came to stand before High King Arthur and High Queen Guinevere, the leopard bowed as a courtier might, and all the court laughed and made much of it. Once Jean had been an alpha, unlooked upon. Now omegas sought to dangle ribbon or silken floss before the kit at their bowers, and were wont to gently shriek at the leopard's huffs. The leopard gave every appearance of being a courtly enough creature. It was true that at times he went into places where he should not be, but it always seemed that these antics revealed aught that should be revealed. Such as when the Green Knight appeared to the court, challenging any to a contest of chopping off each other's heads. As Jean stood up to face the challenge, the leopard leaped upon the Green Knight and batted his head off with a gentle push of his paw. The Green Knight's head sat upon the floor and laughed. "Well played, Prince of Leopards! Well played!" And picking up his head, went on his way, to the court's great comfort. That said, he was still a leopard, even if he was a prince among them. On one occasion, Lady Mary the Blonde, an unbonded omega in the service of High Queen Guinevere, chanced to smile overlong at John. And John, full of sunshine and the beauty of the day on the white snow, smiled back. On seeing that smile, the leopard growled and climbed to the room where the good lady slept and sprayed his marks upon her clothing, and further then made his marks upon Jean's clothes as well. Jean hurried to give Lady Mary the Blonde his apologies for the leopard. The good lady laughed. My kittens do the same when we're off with me. Upon the discussion of cats, Lady Mary the Brown set down her embroidery hoop. Oh, my Tobias is one to cough upon my pillow when I forget his treat. Lady Mary the Red. Although, in truth, it had been some years since the locks of hair that peeked out from her wimple had been aught but silver, said, I once had a sweet little pussy that quite sprayed all over my bonded bed. She smiled as if she carried a chip of ice in her mouth, and then gave way to a gale of laughter from her belly. Lady Mary the Blonde and Lady Mary the Brown quite chased John from the parlor with their enjoying laughter over these Omega matters. John returned to where he slept with the other bachelor knights. He remonstrated the leopard soundly, who only curved his head into his body. Finally, as the leopard sullenly looked up, John dangled his soiled clothes in front of the leopard's nose and delivered 10 swift swats with the flat of his hand to its backside to indicate his displeasure. The other knights were all astonished that the leopard did not rip out John's throat, but instead yowled most piteously and then wantonly twined around John's legs, as if seeking to get back in his good graces. John was set to steal his heart to teach the leopard better behavior, and pushed the leopard away, when, quite suddenly, the leopard stood on his hind legs, as if he were rampant. But rather than bare his teeth, he set to frantic licking at John's neck, and so touched on the mark that mystery had made. John felt a knot in his heart, quite melt, and comforted the leopard. How could I forget that where once I from my love withheld, thinking to engender better behavior, I both caused him pain and got no good result of it. He wrapped his arms around the leopard. I'll not withhold my love again, but still. He tapped his finger on the leopard's nose. Truck with such poor actions. Jean made a point to walk around the court with the leopard in moaning tow and smile at every Omega he saw. The leopard sulked, but not again did he so egregiously misbehave. Rather, he huffed happily when Jean held open his arms that the leopard might rest his head upon John's chest while sleeping. Now, they were not always at the court of Camelot, for Jean and the leopard, with the kit upon John's back, were wont to make their fortune through some adventures. When high King Arthur went to help his kinsman Colwich, when the hand of Olwen, who was the daughter of a giant, it was Jean and the leopard who, in the hunt for the great boar Twitch Twuth, took the razor, comb, and scissors that the boar kept hidden in his bristles. Now I know that some works say it was a dog, but they are quite wrong. It was the leopard, who flushed Twitch Twuth out, with Jean racing after. For if you look at the footprints he left in the stone, it was quite clearly a leopard's. For his assistance, High King Arthur gave to Jean a noble destrier, all in black, that he might more fittingly ride as a knight of his court. When a herd of High King Arthur's cattle were turned into ferns, Jean and the leopard, with Kit safely bundled up, went to find out what had happened to them. Jean would have suspected magic, but in the end it was merely clever cattle thieves. Upon listening to the tale of how the leopard led Jean to the truth, High Queen Guinevere gifted Jean with a golden collar, enriched with gems, and a bracelet likewise enriched, that he might better match his leopard. When Sir Silence looked for a boon companion to journey with her on a quest to battle the dragon and coiled on the southern isles. The child of the serpent, which her father had once slain. It was Jean who stepped forward with the leopard, bounding up to hear more. On that journey, it were Jean who almost grew jealous, as the leopard seemed somewhat taken with the red-haired knight, and her armor painted blue. But in the end, it seemed the leopard merely liked to hear of dragons. While the affections of Sir Silence were entirely bound up by the Lady Lunette, though she was a Beta. After this journey, and as they gifted all the dragon's treasure to the church, that the sin that lay upon it might be washed, High King Arthur approved Sir Silence to her inheritance. Now the dragon was out of it. This was done even though it were revealed that Sir Silence, though doughty in the battlefield, was an Omega, and but pretended at being an Alpha. This quite shocked the court, for never had this been done before. But as Jean pointed out, his leopard was an Omega, and a prince of leopards, too. If none thought it strange he used his teeth and paws in conflicts, then why not an Omega knight? So Silence was a countess confirmed. Now the dragon were dead. Now for his role in that quest, and for his wise words after, High King Arthur granted Jean the keep in the forest of Broceliande, where Jean had first met Mystery. Further, the High King so swore to Jean that he would be granted funds to rebuild it. The list could go on. For a year it did. There were sprites and haunted wells and blessed trees. By bit, did Jean lay out some new foundation of his reputation, to his good fortune. Although, it must be said, for all he was much respected in quests, in Lovecraft he was somewhat laughed at behind soft hands, for as much as he said he'd seek no lord or lady, but would stay true to love, there were some who said such chastity was a necessity. That his lost love had been some villain doxy, surely, who had not died, but merely left him, when it turned out he could perform his part but once, or had some unnatural interests. Here in the foundation of his reputation, the leopard was not so much an advantage. Although, had he heard these rumors, Jean would have been most horrified. But, as he was so well respected for his kindness and bravery, none did more than whisper behind soft hands. Indeed, the Countess Silence was wont to answer such whispers with a silent visage and a mighty blow of her hand, while the Countess's friend, the Lady Lunette, spoke such words that this was not said all too often. All this ended with the return of Lady Vert from her extended confinement in the country, which had been extended for a scandal of which no one would speak, but involved Lord Vert after he was injured in the lists, quite speared in accident by Lady Vert's latest vassal, and much jests were made on that. Now her lord would no more be able to perform an Alpha's part. But at least he had several heirs already. The Lady Vert, truly her name well suited her. She came upon Jean one day and said, "There he is, the Alpha who cannot play his part. I'd heard a rumor that you were Alpha enough to get a harlot Omega with child. But as I see you, I quite doubt it. As you've gained some sort of reputation with your leopards and victories in the field, I'll consider taking you back into my service as my vassal, if you do better than before. Your reputation I will cleanse. If not, well, 'tis clear you are over-affectionate with your leopard. And saying such, I will dance upon the whispered cracks of your reputation, and drive you from all you've but lately gained. There's naught in this world that once granted cannot be taken away. Even with all he stood to lose, Jean did not need to choose his answer. I would not be forsworn. My heart lies in the grave, and there it shall wait until God grants we be buried together. She cursed him then, and not like a lady at all, and would have struck him. But the leopard growled at her most fiercely, and quite scratched her arm. He would have done greater damage, had Jean not restrained him by his golden collar. Jean's heart thundered, for he knew the Lady Verret's great position at court, and feared by his action the leopard would now come to harm for his defense of Jean. Yet, for all of that, he warmed to be so defended, and accepted the leopard's rough, comforting licks, and through all the sleepless night, stroked the sleeping kit. The Romance of Mystery, Book 1, Chapter 7. Now the next day, there was a feast in the honor of the return of Merlin, who had long been absent on a journey of grave import. As that feast began, the Lady Verte, bold as you please, cried out, "I may have been willing to face the disgrace of such a one as Sir John at court, but now I am afeard of my life, for his leopard, with whom Sir John has unnatural relations, has made to attack me." She held up her arm where the leopard had scratched her. "Will no one protect this poor Omega from this dread beast?" All stood in stunned silence, for heretofore the leopard had been a great favorite at court. Into that silence Merlin's laughter fell, pealing like a high silver bell. High King Arthur said, "My dear friend, Merlin, why do you laugh?" Merlin held forth his staff of oak, topped with a beryl stone, and said, "Because nothing is as it seems, and that amuses me. The Lady Verte is no Omega. Lord Verte's sons are not his. The beasts are no beasts." So saying, he waved his staff and stripped falsehood from all. The Lady Verte lost her borrowed perfume, and stood before the court, a Beta revealed. Her confessor likewise, no Beta, but an Alpha. Well, the leopard and kit transformed into mystery, and a boy-child of some 2 years, both clothed in naught but the skin that the Lord God above gave them. Mystery did not seek to cover himself, but bore proudly upon his throat Jean's mark, above the collar of gold all over enriched with gems, while the boy, Kit, laughed and clapped his hands. Jean, who had risen to defend his leopard, fell to his knees, as the mast of a ship may break in a storm, and cried out, "If you are an apparition sent to bedevil me, then grant me only that you remain." Mystery pulled him to his feet and said, "I am no apparition. I was merely transformed. My brother paid the Mother Superior the price you would not take, with one of my own bracelets, to lie to you that you might believe I was dead. They would have kept me from you and taken our child, but that I studied in their great books that I could transform into a leopard, that it would occur as I'd wagered, that my brothers proposed bonded would flee from me in terror." Mystery was most rueful then. I knew the way to become, but could not speak the words to reverse what I had done. I lost myself for a time, and had our child in a mean cave, yet I ever sought you out without knowing what I sought. On seeing you from a distance, immortal love brought me to myself,
and by that love, I remembered myself. In my haste to reach you, by your snared knot, I was once again caught, but with no way to speech, I could but mutely follow. He then turned to the Lady Vert. It is clear by the scent that you wear that you were born to a beta's lot, which by your trickery you have transformed, which would be of no concern of mine, but for the ways you've supported your claims. Further, that you have turned the court against this good Alpha is a sign of your venom. Lady Vert turned quite scarlet then. By magic you bedevil me. How should we value the harlot of an Alpha who cannot satisfy a Lady Omega, who by magic you make appear as a Beta, which I cannot be, for I have 7 children born.
Merlin laughed again. No magic applied, but the ones that I have stripped away. That you are a Beta, and therefore follow as a parent. That you sought to cozen your bonded into foundlings is also without question. Mystery broke in then to this discourse. By the cant of their eyes and the crook of their noses, it is clear that each of the Lord Vert's heirs are actually the sons of his lady's confessor. Merlin nodded. It is even so. The confessor is no Beta and no priest, but a cousin and Alpha of the worst kind. Clearly, I should have not been so long absent from court. High King Arthur was heard to murmur, Indeed, my dear friend, it is so. Such that High Queen Guinevere took up her bonded's hand for a kiss. Mystery said, That is not all. Where a gently bred Omega may not go, a leopard may explore, and so learn many things. The court will find, upon some inquiry, that the confessor's children come of gleaning the villains in the field, having cozened them to pray with him during heat, and thereby rotted with them by a ruse, that he were but a Beta. Furthermore, were consent to take the get, begotten in this shame, were not given. That get was taken quite without consent. Upon which saying, Merlin's face took on the look of the storm, in advance of the rest of the court's expression, and the Lady Vert and her confessor were taken forth to be dealt with later. The bidder now removed from view, Mystery held out his arms wide. Of Sir John, the court should know that I fully intended on going to a convent in Broceliande, that I might take the veil there, and turn from the world to the study of mystery. He in no way knew that I was born the son of the King of Logres, and thus am I a prince of highest estate. Upon my heat and in my innocence, I begged of this noble knight a stroke or two to ease my suffering, as if he were but a Beta, and for which Beta strokes I had full papal dispensation for 20, and further was owed in arrears some 500 more. So generous is his heart that he would have stopped at but one. But for the joy his staff brought, I urged him ever on to my ruin. Even then he saw to my pleasure such that as he spilled his prima materia within me, I fairly heard the angels singing hallelujah. You see here the precious result of my folly. Mystery picked up Kit, who laughed much as the kit had been wont to mew. Jean would have blushed then, were he to have blushes left, but he had so greatly missed Mystery's frankness that he blushed with love. Mystery looked first to Merlin, and at his nod addressed Jean. To my sorrow, you may as well know that the spell I undertook has its consequences. I may wear this shape by day, and a leopard's by night, or the reverse, but not both. Which then would be your preference? Jean took Mystery's hands within his own, that he might kiss them, and kiss Kit too. As you desire, so desire I.
Worry not, for that was but a ruse, a test not for you, but so the court might see your true mettle. Mystery took the golden bracelet from around his right arm and placed it upon Jean's, for all it left him now entirely unclothed, for he was still quite as nude as the day he was born, and took from Jean the bracelet around his own arm, that they might be exchanged, in that this court call him ungenerous, unobservant, I call you. High Queen Guinevere on her throne inclined her head, crowned all in gold and gems, and said, It would seem it is so. She ordered that clothes be brought for Mystery's modesty, although all could see he had none. When it was done, she put her hand upon High King Arthur's, in that a knight of the Table Round has sinned against the purity of an Omega of royal breeding. He must then pay the price for what he owes. As he is of our table, so we see to it that he may settle on this Omega prince the owed dower settlement, and thus in bond mend what this knight has tattered. So it was that Jean was endowed as a count, that his rank might be fitting. High King Arthur himself negotiated the proper dower settlement for Mystery, with Arthur's vassal, the King of Logris. Mystery argued they should have none of it, and they'd live in the green forest as sinners, and then the sin would be on those who opposed their bond. Despite Mystery, a rich dower settlement of a county in Broceliande, and the fees from a market town were settled on Mystery, and it was agreed that Jean and Mystery were to be betrothed, and a still further time for their bonding was set, when next Mystery's heat lay upon them. Prince Mycroft came to Camelot to sign the settlements that would pass a guardian's task to High King Arthur, and from thence to Jean, at Mystery's growl, as if still a leopard he were. Prince Mycroft said, Brother, never would our father have granted the path you set. He paused in dipping the nib of his pen in the pot of ink. I thought to give you to an alpha of means, but in the end it would seem your solution was the better. So saying, he set his name upon the agreement. Stultus et sictum int altieri. Jean set his nib to the contract with no hesitation, saying only mildly, Fool's journey well ended. By his glance, Prince Mycroft agreed that it was so, and went on his way, leaving Mystery to the gentle care of the court, with legal ties now set, until such time as a bond could be formed in the eyes of God. Now, for much of the time, Mystery set to study with Merlin, while Kit, who had been the bower's darling, was the bower's darling still. Mystery delved deeply into the sea of knowledge, and ever emerged freshly bathed in brilliance. While Mystery studied the mysteries that bound the world, Jean took up rhetoric, for much had he thought during the long nights that Mystery had been dead, upon what he might have done differently. It was time Jean laid siege for love. It was actually quite a marvel that they managed to meet at all, for so little did Mystery restrain his cries, and so effective were Jean's arguments. And in truth, little did Mystery bother to resist. In fact, at times, Mystery made his own assault, and they quite traded places. But fully, Jean worked to show that it was not his intent to withhold his love. Jean sat at Mystery's feet in Merlin's study and said, Mystery, as we are betrothed, it is as if we were bonded in the eyes of the law, and as we are bonded, it were no sin for you to grant me a kiss. His kiss was granted, and Mystery would rather have granted more besides, had not Lady Mary the Blonde interrupted them, as they went into the woods at the skirts of Camelot a maying. Jean said, As we are not bonded, I may yet still improve myself through the grant of your love. As you love me, will you not help me to my improvement? Mystery granted that much can be improved about Jean,
and as all the court nearby danced round the Mayday pole, mystery worked on loudly burnishing Jean's claws amid the flowers. That is, until Lady Mary the Brown set to chiding them on their disorder, and made Mystery sit next to her at the feast. Jean got on bended knee and bargained that he was sure to do something dire if he was left thirsty after so many years of drought. The ruin of which you are so proud was long ago and needs fresh coat. Mystery required a window, that Jean might more properly ruin him, for as he had paid the price of ruin, and would soon have his reputation mended, he reasoned he should get further pleasure of ruin now. Here, Jean did manage to find a window, no more than an arrow slit, that faced out into the wall of a tower. It mattered not. Jean had not reckoned on the way Mystery's deep voice echoed on the stones, as the deepest church bell echoes when tolling the birth of the future king. So it was that Lady Mary the Red found them, and chided John for at least an hour. When that were done, she handed him a wide strip of thick linen and said, "You may find the Eastern Tower a better place. As between Vespers and Compline, the guard do not go there." So to the Eastern Tower they made their way, and with the linen in Mystery's mouth to muffle him, they set about repainting ruin with great haste. In truth, their bonding could not have come soon enough for either of them. As time would have it, Mystery's heat came once more upon him, so the bonding ceremony was now finally held in formal pomp before all the court and the chambers set aside for them. Naked they both stood, as all the knights of the Table Round held up the sheet under which they were bonded, Kit at their side, that he might be acknowledged a child born beneath that sheet. They exchanged the words before the bishop, and made again their marks, which the bishop freshly anointed with holy oil, that the marks might be writ upon their flesh. Immortal Love smiled, for it left no greater mark than she'd already made with her kiss. Kit was taken to his nap, and they to their bonded bed. As before the witnesses, Jean entered into Mystery, and so great were Mystery's cries on the subject of Jean's mighty knot, and great girth, and fulsome length, and goodly staff work besides, that Jean tapped him upon the hip, that he might focus upon what they were at, and not their audience. After which, Mystery's cries took on his more heavenly praise. As their first bonded knot took hold, and the witnesses left them to their privacy, they exchanged more loving words. Jean asked them, "My love, tell me again the name to which you were born." Mystery smiled. "It bears some resemblance to the state we now find ourselves in. However, I became a student of the greatest of mysteries the moment you took up my request and gave me my first stroke." So it was that John took up as his crest a black leopard, rampant with a collar of gold, and as his motto he took, "Clausum Mysterium," with which none could argue, having been made witness. Now, while this story I now end, I am not yet finished, but the mirror of this tale I will now tell, and any mystery so remove.